Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, continuing with our ongoing exploration of the problems and solutions to the crisis at BAI and Pacifica, trying to sort through all of the claims and counterclaims, all of the ideas that are out there to see which are legitimate and which are not. And unless we have all the facts at hand, then any decisions we make could be causing a problem that will not solve itself or will not have any constructive remedial action taken. Right now, there are divided camps with very strong issues about what the problems are. And I've taken the time to interview so many people to get their perspective. And of course, sometimes it's not always the leaders of movements who can give you the best perspective. Frequently, people don't want to acknowledge that they've made errors in judgment or have their own agendas. And the public is caught in a difficult situation. Who do you believe? What is true? What is fact? What is fiction? Unless you've done your own investigation, unless you've actually taken each and every single charge and then seen where's the evidence to support it or where's the evidence to challenge it, then you're going to be frequently more often than not manipulated. And I've seen some massive manipulation on all sides. I have seen so many contradictions, and yet continuing the attacks does not cause a healing. Bringing the facts out, examining them in an impartial and unfair-minded way, giving all sides an opportunity to present their side, then try to say, all right, what do we do now? Now, what I'm doing is I'm arranging and already have a series of meetings with people from all points of view, bring them together so that we can start making constructive change, one that benefits the mission of the Pacifica, its audience, and not necessarily the careers, egos of the individual people involved all the time. In fact, I a little later, time permitting, I'll read a letter from Samori Marksman, a letter that warned what would happen if you did not have a competent professional station manager and program director who could see that the small little self-serving cliques that exist in all the stations, that frequently and certainly in the case of WBAI, have controlled it, have virtually controlled the programming, and once they get three or four or five people together, they can intimidate, harass, and they can keep on the air, or they can keep in their position of power, irrespective of who that station manager is. And I've seen this. And that does not benefit the station, the larger mission of what this station is supposed to represent, or the audience. And yet the public's never aware of this. They're never aware what goes on behind the scenes. Only what they hear on the air. And the standards. There's a lot of fighting now over standards. One group wants to have more professional standards of accountability. Another group wants no standards and no accountability. Certain individuals within these groups want to see programming expanded, others want to see it limited. So you have all different types of political, ideological, and personal agendas involved. And if you've got 16 different chefs trying to make a soup, it's not generally going to be palatable to anybody's taste. And frequently that's where we find ourselves at this moment. In some ways, it's actually good that a crisis like this occurs, because frequently, if we learn from the crisis, then we can help prevent what caused it from happening again. We can reconstruct a stronger foundation upon which to go forward. If we do not learn from these crises, then we are going to perpetuate them. I just want the audience to know that unless we start dialoguing without attacking one another, and that's what's been going on, and I am very much opposed to many of the tactics used against individuals. I believe that one of the things BAI and Pacifica represents is a platform for different ideas, I may disagree with someone's opinion, but I should not be in a position to attack them personally because I disagree with their opinion. And yet right now the idea is, if you don't agree with us, you're the enemy. And so suddenly anyone who is not supporting one side is considered the enemy. Well, that's fascism. And liberalism, communism, leftism can be as fascist as anything from the right. And we always have thought, well, you know, the kind of McCarthyism, blacklisting, inquisitional attitudes are purely something from a radical, rabid right-wing perspective. Not true. Not true, I can assure you. I've seen it. And so we are seeing intolerance. Intolerance on all levels. And we shouldn't have that intolerance. And we shouldn't have selective prosecution or persecution of individuals. That's also occurring. And I wouldn't have known this had I not done this investigation in depth, taken the time to look for facts. And I've seen people vilified who simply did not deserve it. Now, if I have one person say, Gary, I believe that there should be stronger station management from people who have a background in station management, but who also understand the kind of station that BAI or KPFA or KPF, all the other stations are. And we're going to hold standards. And the fact that we're contributing to public interest issues doesn't mean we have to bottom feed in quality of who goes on the air. And historically, there were no standards to get on the air. There were no standards to manage the station. There were no standards for anything. And some people want to raise those standards. And other people are fighting any input into how they do their shows or how they do their programming or how they manage issues. And so you really have ideological differences. And you have to speak to both people to see their arguments. And versus local control versus national control, and local input versus national input. And it's not necessarily a easily divisible issue. So sometimes what we're told the issues are not. And at this moment, we're told there's a massive, you know, right-wing conspiracy to take over the station by capitalists. And I'm saying, prove it. Where's your facts? Because if you're inciting people to take action, and if your facts are wrong, then you've misled people. And that is not something that should be tolerated. If there are differences of opinions on how programming should be done, how stations should be managed, accountability, union representation, fair wages, having local and national input together, then sit down and resolve those issues. Create forums where the whole point of the forum is to resolve an issue, where fair representation is brought together. There's a whole lot of difference between having something that starts off as ideological differences that ends up being conspiratorial differences. If no conspiracy exists, then get it to where the argument should be. Because otherwise, right now, there are people who are making illegal acts. People are breaking, hacking into people's computers. And people trying to destroy people's livelihoods. And people who are being forced, intimidated through threats, and coercion, and blackmail to quit their jobs or to leave the board. I'd like to know what's democratic about that. I'd like to know what is correct about that. If the only way you can win an argument is by intimidation and threats, then how valid is your argument? I would not accept that from either side as being a legitimate recourse to disagreements. Let's go now. And on my last program, I was just within a minute of the end of the show, and we had a technical glitch where someone picked up a telephone and knocked my guest off the air before I could say goodbye to her. But in any case, we had not finished the interview, and she was one of the more objective, fair-minded individuals in this entire issue. And because she has worked as an active activist for so long inside WBAI, contributing at the local board, being a union representative, she's covered all the bases. And yet people don't know who she is, haven't heard from her, the general public, I'm suggesting. And it's important that we get her perspective, because she doesn't seem to have an axe to grind. So I'm, and yet she will still have her own political and ideological, you know, input. And all that must be kept in mind. Everyone has their own ideology. If you're conservative, or if you're a liberal, if you are a come from a free market concept, or you come from a entitlement concept, those will all those will shade your particular view. They'll slam it. So there is no such thing as being completely fair-minded in anything. You can only be as fair-minded as your values and beliefs allow you to be. And we must keep that in mind as well. Thank you once again for coming back to continue your thoughts with us, Sybil Wong.
Hi.
Hi. Ms. Wong, when you were last on the program, you spoke about what was occurring at the station, and I want to now focus on the station, WBAI, and especially on the allegations and charges that were occurring, that Utrice Lee, the interim station manager, was a part of some conspiracy to take over the station and to gut it, and etc. I'd like you to focus on what was occurring at that time inside, especially with the program director's position and the station manager's position, and the climate and temperament, the mood and the actions, so we get a perspective on it.
Quickly, you know, Utrice Lee was brought into WBAI by, at that time, program director Samori Marksman. Samori brought Utrice Lee and invited her as a host of a program called Talk Back in the afternoon across the board, Monday to Friday, 3 to 5. And it was a very popular program. And everything seemed to be working, you know, quite well at WBAI, except when Samori passed away. When Samori passed away, we urged, of course, to set up, the general manager to set up a search committee for the next program director. The search committee was formed very carefully by 9 elected or selected people. 3 selected by the local advisory board, 3 by the pay staff. They're usually the 3 department heads at WBAI: public affairs, news, and arts. And it's 3 unpaid staff elected by his or her union peers went through this election. I was elected by, at that time I was an unpaid staff. I already left WBAI. I was elected by my union, non-pay members of the union, Local 404, to be a member of the PD, Program Director Search Committee. And we went through about 3 months of search and about 2 months of intensive interview. And the 2 people who came out our final elections is Utrice Lee and Laura Flander. But unfortunately, the general manager at that time decided to ignore the advice of the search committee.
Valerie Van Isser.
To ignore the recommendation from the search committee of 9 people and decided to pick Bernard White as the program director, even though Bernard White was eliminated from the first round after the first round of interview. He was not even brought back for the second round of interview. So there was obviously this tremendous uproar and protest, not only from the search committee, but from the staff in general, that Valerie Van Isser could not really take independent decision, undemocratic, dictatorial decision to install someone to the program director at WBAI. I think that really started to create 3 factions, I would say, at WBAI. One is pro-Bernard White, pro-Valerie Van Isser, and Isser's choice of Bernard White as a PD. The other faction is anti-Valerie's election or choice of Bernard White. The third, I will call them like a Producers Without Borders. They are the neutral ones. They are not saying that, you know, what Valerie did or what Bernard did was right or wrong. They're trying to stay in the middle, saving their own programs and see what happened. That, Gary, that really, really created this faction, the WBAI. And the PD position was, since it was decided, there's nothing much the staff can do. Talk about democratization. At that time, this is very suspicious to me and unfortunate. The people who are now screaming for democratization of WBI National Board has never protested at that time when the general manager had taken such undemocratic action. And so, now, we need to have an interim general manager at WBI. Bessie Walsh at that time was the executive director, and she looked around, and she listened to people at WBI, and because she really wanted someone from internal WBI to be interim general manager and not someone from the outside. So she decided to offer that position to Jose San Diego, at that time who was the news director. And after certain investigation, in fact, you mentioned it in your first report, you know, Jose's position about the condition, you know, whereby, you know, he should be or should not be accepting this position. He did, after the conditions were met by the executive director at Pacifica. But however, when he announced to the staff, and they were up in arms against Jose, because certain people now have actually changed their mind, they decide to maintain Varig and Isla to be the general manager. Even though the argument was that why are you now protecting Larry Van Isla, even though you and other people, the majority of the staff and the LAB wanted to remove her at that time. Eventually, Gary, I think you should actually ask those people, why were they protecting, refusing Pacific to come into room, remove Larry? I did talk to Amy Goodman, and I did talk to a few of the other people, and they came on saying that the national cannot dictate to the local what the local should do. Even though I told Amy Goodman and other people that unfortunately, unless we change the bylaw at the national level, the bylaw stated that the executive director at the national level hire and fire the general manager at each station. Okay, maybe it was undemocratic, but 50 years that has been working that way. But now suddenly, they want to change, they said, undemocratic. Maybe it's undemocratic. But we should sit down, maybe re-elect the national board, change the bylaws in such a sense and said that each station has input into selecting the general manager. But so far, in the bylaws, it does say the local advisory board can advise or have certain input into the national about the hiring of the general manager. So now going back to Jose. Since Jose is under such pressure, his father was terribly ill in the hospital, so he declined a job as a general manager. And then they had a meeting, and people said to you, Trees, that you're about the second best person out of Jose San Diego to be able to bring the whole station together. So Utrecht rang up Bessie Walsh and offered to apply for the job. And also she put up certain conditions. You can talk to Utrecht about that, about 10 or 15 conditions. And Bessie Walsh accepted those conditions. And consequently, Utrecht was appointed interim general manager. Now, as far as I understand, I know Utrecht quite well, actually. She and I were fellow shop stewards at one time at WBEI. I know that after her PD position was given to Bernard White, I'm sure there must be an ill feeling towards Bernard White or towards Larry Van Isla. But she had no ambition, as far as I understand, until up to that time, wanting to be interim general manager. In fact, when Jose was being appointed or mentioned to be appointed, Utrecht actually encouraged Jose to take the job. So I think that should be made known. Eventually, after what she had done, maybe it's not agreeable by a lot of staff and listeners, but up to that point, she has no manipulating behind the scene to take the job as a general manager, interim general manager. Because it was over to Jose, she encouraged Jose to take it. It's after the such pressure to put on Jose, and after he removed himself from being interim general manager, that Utrecht applied and she became general manager. And that is a true sequel, as I said, after I'm very much like you, I have been a journalist for 30 years, Gary. I always go to my prime sources. I must have talked to about 20 or 30 producers at the stations. And find out, I talked to Jose, Utrecht, et cetera, et cetera. Find out really what went on during those months leading up into December 23rd, the midnight December 33rd, so-called a coup or counter-coup, whereby Utrecht was installed as the interim general manager.
Okay, good. Let me put it in, let me summarize it and see if it's an accurate summation of your thoughts, all right? There had been an effort inside the station to remove Valerie Van Isser by the staff, by volunteers and managers of departments, and even by the local community board. They were not happy with her. Her lack of accountability, her lack of openness, and other issues that people have told me about. Then there was actually, according to Samori Markson's meeting, and I do have Samori Markson's memos, they had actually called in at one point Lynn Chadwick and before that Pat Scott and asked, what can we do about, you know, getting a different station manager? Finally, her contract was not going to be renewed, and she knew that well in advance. She'd also been put on some disciplinary action, and then Bessie Walsh, according to two independent people I interviewed who were present at meetings where Valerie and Bessie were at, was offered what they considered actually a better job, a less stressful job, and one that they felt that her quality and talent would be better able to do, and that was as the executive producer at the national level, and actually with a $7,000 salary increase. Valerie turned it down. Valerie then began a process of organizing her own support within the station, and she met with some of the people, and then it became a let's not let Valerie go, even by people who had been a part of the effort to get rid of Valerie, now turned around and started to support Valerie. At the same time, after Samori died, there was a directive to search for a new program director. And there were certain qualifications people had to meet, including having a certain number of votes before they could go to each level of the interview process. Bernard White did not even get past the first set. He was never called back for a second round of interviews. He was excluded. The person who ended up from the local community board and the department heads and all those who were involved was Valerie Van Isler. So it was a recommendation to the station manager through a democratic process that Utrecht Lead be the new program director. Valerie Van Isler said no and insisted upon Bernard White. Many people felt that that was wrong because Bernard White had not been democratically selected by the process that was supposed to occur. And even though technically the station manager could override, many felt that it really rubbed everyone wrong because if you're going to have a democratic process, then honor it. If it's just going to be a sham, then just say, well, all this process doesn't matter because in the end I'm going to do what I want to do. And so Bernard was selected program director over the objections and over the selection of Utrecht Lead, which could have then set into motion some antagonism between Utrecht and Bernard White. In any case, now comes the time when Valerie is being removed, as was the right by the bylaws of the executive director. The executive director in the bylaws, which, by the way, I've actually set and read them, does give her the right to do this. And that has always been the case with all the five Pacifica stations throughout its history. It is not that the local board elects a program or elects a station manager. They may give their input. They may make recommendations. They may give their thoughts. But in the end, it is the executive director of the Pacifica Foundation that makes that choice. So Bessie Walsh says, we're going to select someone inside this system to do this because, A, I think it would be better. I spoke with her and I spoke with other people who were aware of meetings that she had on the selection process. She did not want to bring someone from the outside in. She wanted to bring someone that would have been more responsible and more acceptable to the community board and to the station, and hence selected Jose Santiago because he did not have a reputation for being self-serving or antagonistic. He was considered a very capable news director and didn't belong to any clique. But at that time, there were cliques inside the station and who preferred autonomy, didn't want anyone telling what to do or how to do it, and who pretty much did what they did. They then began to back Valerie. For what reason? We'll never know. There's only supposition, there's only theory, there's only hypothesis. And one is just as invalid as another because it's all speculative. But the reality is they back Valerie. The very people who said, let's get rid of Valerie for years now said, well, we support Valerie. And when they were talking about democratic principles of, you know, you got to do this democratically, the very people who had not accepted the democratic principles when it came to electing a program director. Behind all this was Utrice Lead, who had nothing to do with any of this, except as far as knowing what was going on at the national level. I have checked all of the records, and I have not found where she had any meetings with Bessie Walsh prior to any of this, didn't even have a conversation with her. In fact, Bessie Walsh was not sympathetic to Utrice because at one point Utrice had refused for one part of one fund drive not to raise funds because of an issue of the premium being offered. The publisher had not been paid, and she felt that it was, and this was a small publisher who could not afford not to be paid, and he hadn't been paid for two previous fund drives, and they were insisting that she go on the air and pitch a particular premium, and she said, but this man has been paid for the last two drives, and this could cause him to go bankrupt. And so only at the insistence that you, Valerie Venisser pay the man, and finally was paid, then she went out on a pitch. Bessie Walsh wasn't aware of all this. She simply got word that Utrice should be removed. And so after examining it, she decided to put her on a warning, but not to remove her. So Bessie and the national people were not friendly with Utrice. And that has to be established. That has to be understood. So Utrice was actually a supporter of Jose, and I got seven different people who said that she was supporting Jose in becoming general manager. But the reality is Jose was attacked. He was attacked viciously. He was threatened. He was threatened at every level that if he took this job, that his life would be miserable, nobody would cooperate, and he would have no support. And he didn't believe this, and a few days later, he started to see the threats and the intimidation, and so he just said, with my father in the hospital, in a life-death situation, I don't need this. And he declined it. Only at that point, when Jose spoke with Utrice, and Utrice then said that she would consider that position, and then she thought about it, and she gave a series of conditions that there be no programming changes, no meddling by the national board, no additional issues. And when they agreed upon that, then she became the manager. That's very important because of the claims that have been made that she was a part of a national right-wing capitalist conspiracy to take it over. All I'm asking people to do are look at facts. Whatever choice you make up after that is your choice. But if you're making your choice based upon any false assumptions, now that only takes us up to the time when the station changed hands in management. And they had actually given Valerie until the end of the month to complete her work there and to make a transition. And when the keys were asked for, so they can make that transition, no keys were forthcoming. In fact, there was no lock working on the front door and had been for a year and a half. And now there was internal crisis at the station of one group wanting to hold on to Valerie and rallying around her, and another group who was just neutral. And in effect, there was just Bessie and Utrice. And actually, Bessie had gone back to Washington. There was just Utrice there. When she started hearing on the air about how the station was being taken over, and there had been a gag rule, and she felt that And by the way, I had actually spoken with people who were managing the station in the 1960s. There had always been that gag rule. In fact, the gag rule had actually been applied to me on occasions when I had found that there were problems that I felt deserved to be aired, and I was told if I went on the air, I would be taken off the air if I discussed these issues at all. And so I chose not to. Betsy said that when she came up to New York at an urgent request, she's listening to people on air talking about taking over the station and doing a sit-in in the studios. And there were already dozens of people who were at the studios, and things were being stolen. A lot of things were being stolen. And there was no security. And it was that point that just Bessie and Utrice decided that they had to have some security in place. That brings us up to that moment. Now, beyond that, and the events that occurred after that, will be a topic for another discussion. Is that a fair summation of the events?
It's very fair. Gary, but when you said that we never know why certain people have changed positions in supporting Vary, I think that need to be investigated. But my own analysis, as I mentioned before, is really about power and controlling programming and pay positions here at WBAI. You know, the power base of certain people are given by the general manager. So if the general manager was going to be removed, therefore your power base and your programming may be eroded. And my own analysis is that general manager must be kept in place in order to maintain your power base, your program, and your positions.
So in other words, if I understand what you're saying, you're suggesting that you believe people supported Valerie staying in her position even though they had advocated her removal, because if she was removed, then a new general manager coming in who didn't know anyone would not allow the cliques that were self-serving to have their own way. So they were really doing it not because of some greater community virtue, but because of their own pure self-interest.
That's my reading on it. But unfortunately or fortunately, that the language that's being used now is talking about free speech radio, community radios, democracy, democratization of the board, etc., have persuaded most of the so-called left progressive forces in this country to support this movement. I would urge everyone to actually look into this, you know, before you really taking sides and said that certain people must be purged and must be removed. I really think that in order to have an honest network, Pacifica and the five stations serving the communities, is that we've got to go back to have the boards, both local boards and the national boards, being democratically elected by the listeners. So that, you know, if the bylaw is not going to be changed, again, the power given to the local stations are through the national board. The national board would still hire and fire the general manager, maybe because the national board now is democratically elected, that the firing and the hiring will be more fair. Once the general manager is hired, he has total autonomy over local programming and over local hiring. So all that process, Gary, we have to really seriously put it into place.
I absolutely agree, and all of our efforts are to make it a truly democratic process. I'll end our discussion with one comment and your final statement on my comment. The current environment is one of persecution and vilification, demonization of individuals, as if they are guilty simply because they have a different point of view. I do not believe that that has any constructive place in causing a healing and reform of the system, both locally and nationally. And if all that can be done is to force people who disagree with you out of their positions, what in the world is democratic about that?
Now, I understand, you know, my email terrible, and I should actually keep my computer in repair in good shape, but it isn't. I understand that, you know there are three lawsuits right now against Pacifica. One is taken up by some of the dissident members of the National Board, one is taken up by the Local Advisory Board, and one is taken up by the listeners. I understand there might be some settlement, some movement next week. Unfortunately, I don't have any input into this. I think you should investigate and see. I think there's a lawyer out, attorney out in California, who's going to meet with all the plaintiffs and see if there's any settlement can be made on this. I think that whatever settlement we're going to make, we should really insist upon having the listeners. I mean, you know, there are many listener groups that are activated many years ago. Like in KPFA, there's a Take Back KPFA, and there's a Free Pacifica, the Pacifica Listener Unions, the SOS, there's the Coalition for Democracy, Democratic Pacifica, and the Pacifica Campaign. All these people should really have input, you know, into what is going to take place next in the forming of the local board and the national board.
You're right. If we're truly to be representative of all the voices within the community, then all the voices have to have a forum where they can be heard, not just a small group. And unfortunately, the small vocal group frequently will control what occurs. Then you're right back to where you started, self-serving cliques, depending upon whatever their ideology.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, the mass people do not become involved in issues. And it's to their detriment that they don't become involved in issues and informed of issues.
True. For example, I know the Friends of WBI have been organizing, and I think there's about 2,000 to 3,000 active listeners in this listening area, WBI, in the struggle. But there are 17,000 pay subscribers and listeners to WBI. What happened to the other 15,000 or 14,000 listeners? They have not been in part taking part in this struggle. And I think we should encourage everyone to come out, you know, to give the voice. Remember the vision, the Pacifica vision stated by Lou Hill was a station for the voiceless. You know, and all these voiceless, the 10 to 12,000 people who are voiceless should really come out and take part, you know, to make it the people's station.
I absolutely agree with you. Ms. Wong, thank you very much for coming on and sharing your insights with us.
You're welcome, Gary.
Hi. That's Sybil Wong, who is the business manager at BAI. She has been active at the union, at the lab, local advisory board, and she has had an insider's view of all these issues, and this is the first time she has had a forum to speak out, and we're happy to provide that forum. In a moment, we will continue with our discussion on the issues of BAI and the Pacific crisis, looking at the problems and solutions. Well, join us to continue our forum today is Juan Gonzalez. Juan Gonzalez is known as a journalist with the New York Daily News, and also he is one of the heads of an organization that is challenging the Pacifica Foundation and WBAI. Nice to have you with us today, Juan.
Thank you for having me, Gary.
Well, I'm always a believer that one of the ways we resolve issues is looking at how each person sees the problem and what they see as the solution. And that's what I'd like to have you do now, is give you an opportunity for my audience to share with us, what do you see the primary problem to be?
Well, as some of your listeners may or may not know, I resigned as co-host of Democracy Now! Back in late January, when I became frustrated over what I felt was an increasingly bad direction that I thought the Pacifica Foundation, especially the board of directors, was heading in. And I think the main, if to sum it up, I think what's happened over the past few years, unbeknownst to many of us who were not paying close attention, either who worked for Pacifica or who were listeners, the board at Pacifica has instituted a series of changes, many of which are really suspect as to whether they're even legally able to do that. But the basic change was a change of governance in terms of how board members were selected. And an increasing attempt by the board to silence any opposition to what many believe were unjust, illegal methods that they employed to change their own bylaws and to basically shut out listeners and the community from any direct participation in the governance of Pacifica. And I think this is a critical issue because from that everything else flowed. From a decision to take away the powers of the local advisory boards of the five stations to have a say in who would sit on the board. And then the decision by the board increasingly to prevent anyone who opposed that, either in the local advisory boards, on the staffs, or among the listeners, to voice their concern over this policy direction. I think what that did is it set in motion a movement toward dictatorship. And a dictatorship very similar to many of the other for-profit corporations that we are, that many of us here in capitalist America have grown accustomed to having to deal with, but we never expected we'd have to deal with that at Pacifica. And that's why we launched a campaign to end what we've called corporate takeover of Pacifica, an attempt to ape corporate models of decision-making and top-down orders and policies at Pacifica, aping what has occurred in the rest of America and, unfortunately, the rest of the mass media.
Mm-hmm. What exactly have they done that's illegal? Do you have specifics for us?
Well, the most critical thing is that the board changed the bylaws a few years back to basically eliminate the ability of the local advisory boards to name members to the board. They did it at a time when some of the people who were representing the local advisory boards were specifically told by their local advisory boards that they should vote against it. They did it at a time when there were some people voting on the board whose terms had expired, so there were even questions as to whether they had the right to take those votes. And this is what is the subject of three separate lawsuits now that are making their way through the California courts, one by the local advisory boards, by members of, I think, at least four of the local advisory boards, another by some of the other members of the boards, and the third by a listener's lawsuit, and all challenged the legality of the boards having changed its method of selection. Now, the board at the time claimed that they had to do this because the Corporation for Public Broadcasting was threatening to cut off Pacifica's funding if its method of selection of board members did not change to a, in essence, a self-nominating or self-perpetuating board. But the reality is that Pat Scott, who was the executive director at the time, in effect tried to get the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to intercede and to threaten that funding. And we have, in fact, in the documents that we've put out in which we call the Pacifica Files, we have copies of the correspondence that went back and forth between the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and Pacifica, where it's clear that Pat Scott initiated that review. But basically, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting at the time supplied a very small percentage of Pacifica funds. And so even if they threatened to cut off funding, it was not going to be the death of Pacifica. And instead, the board chose to change its governance structure. And, of course, this is the big battle that is, I believe, I'm confident that if it ever does go to trial, that the board is going to lose that fight over its governance changes.
Right now, you're helping direct a campaign to have the board members that you would challenge removed.
Yes.
Could you explain what methods are being used in that campaign?
Well, the two main methods that we enunciated at the Pacifica campaign from the very beginning were both methods that initially were very controversial and still are, but I think have been very effective. One was a listener boycott of funds to all five Pacifica stations on the theory that basically since Pacifica receives most of its funds from listeners. And since listeners and local advisory boards had been shut out of decision-making by the board's recent policy changes, the only way for the listeners to be heard, the only vehicle for them to have, in essence, create a national referendum on Pacifica's policies was by the listeners withholding their money. Pacifica could not continue to change its bylaws and its governance structures and ignore whether the listeners supported that or not. And unfortunately, the only way to have a national listener referendum was through people choosing through their pocketbooks to decide whether they supported the board policies or not. So that was one tactic, the boycott. The second tactic was what we called a direct action campaign to attempt to pressure the board members to leave the board. The theory behind that being that we all know that in America, even though there are three court suits in California, the courts are a very strange animal in the United States of America. First of all, they take an interminably long time. The lawsuits which were filed in 1999 are not even expected to go to trial until probably the beginning of 2002, and whoever wins would then appeal it. So we saw a possibility of a 4 or 5 year process during which the Pacifica board was, as I call it, established. They were very similar to the Israeli state. They are creating a reality on the ground in the Pacifica network while they continue to battle in the courts. And we felt that a little bit like the Palestinians, the settlers keep coming while the Israelis keep saying they want to talk. The Pacifica board continues to revamp the network, ban and fire people all across all of the stations, change the programming while it continues to battle in the courts. Therefore, we felt that time was of the essence, and the only way that we could have a mass movement have impact on Pacifica's policies was through a direct action campaign against the board members, in essence to hold them responsible for their actions, but to do it in a peaceful way, to do it in a legal way, whether that meant picketing, protests, email campaigns, anything that is legal as a form of collective expression of discontent by the listeners against the board.
What if you're wrong? What would happen if you targeted these people and one day you find out that they simply were not the people you thought they were in their actions? And I ask you that because, do you remember the McMartin case in California?
Mm-hmm.
Your newspaper had a journalist there at the time who railed against them, and every single attack that this journalist made, a woman journalist, was they were guilty. You know, forget the trial, they're guilty. And I kept wondering about that, and the charges were so outrageous and the offense so egregious, I went out to California to do my own investigation. I was curious about this, and I spent some time down in San Diego and in Los Angeles and interviewing people, and it just occurred to me that the kids could not have been accurate, that something had been feeding all this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided not to do any shows on this topic, instead to ask other journalists, and I actually asked journalists, I said, go and do your own investigation. Don't trust just what the people are saying, because in America we do have the presumption of innocence.
Right.
And that's why we do have due process. In the end, every single major newspaper, minor newspaper that I read, every broadcast I heard, condemned them prior to their trial. There was one problem. After 7 years, the most lengthy and expensive trial in California history, they were proven innocent of all charges. There was never an apology. There was never any reprieve. Bucky, who was the son, they wouldn't even give him bail. And when you're accused of child molestation and you're put into jail, you're called it's a short eye, and they go after you. And I'm thinking, when no one would acknowledge they were wrong after they were proven innocent, not a single charge was shown to be legitimate. And even later, it was shown that the kids were coached and that there was a social worker involved and people had their own agendas. And from that day forward, I've always said, let us assume innocence until proof of guilt is established beyond a reasonable doubt. And I'm asking you, with the campaign going, and you and I both know that even though legitimate complaints can be lodged, legitimate grievances can exist, you can also draw people into the melee that may not be playing by anyone's rules.
Well, you know, Gary, I would rather, instead of using innocence and guilt, my viewpoint is I'm a person who always believes the best of people until I'm proven otherwise. And that's why it took me over 2 years of watching the Pacifica crisis unfold from afar. I kept saying, well, you know, they'll work it out. You know, they'll be able to get it together even after what happened in Berkeley. Pacifica's always had these kinds of internal struggles. This is just another one. And I kept saying, this too shall pass. But the reality was that this was a markedly different crisis, because I think anybody who has spent time dealing with the current members of the board of Pacifica, and I have, because a year before I resigned, I spoke to the board. I was asked to come in and make a presentation to the board, and I also in August of last year, several months before I resigned, wrote a long letter to Bessie Wash and to the other management over what were my concerns about the way that Democracy Now! And Amy Goodman were being treated by the network. And so I attempted over about a year and a half of my own communications. I met with Steve Yasko. He came to New York. We had about a two-hour meeting. I explained to him my perspective. This was all before I resigned, before I decided to launch this campaign. And I kept waiting to see if the board would change. It did not. And as I grew to get more information about the members of the board, I realized that many of the current people do not come from the progressive movement that made Pacifica what it is. They did not come out of mass struggles. They did not come out of major battles of the civil rights movement or the movement for Puerto Rican liberation or black liberation or the environmental movement. But they're basically sort of like Clinton New Democrats. Who technocrats, basically, neoliberal technocrats, who saw in Pacifica an underutilized resource that they could take in the direction that they envision is part of their agenda. And because they don't come out of that movement, and I don't blame them for not coming out of that movement, but they disdain the movement that gave rise to Pacifica. If you've ever heard any of John Murdoch's statements to the press or Bert Lee's or some of the others who have spoken out, they have this attitude that the listeners of Pacifica, many of them are stuck in back in the 1960s. They're stuck in the radical era of the past. That's over with. We're living in a new America, and we have to professionalize and improve and mainstream our product. This is the kind of vision that they have. That's fine. They have a perfect right to that vision. They have a perfect right to fight for that vision. They do not have a right to utilize illegal, dictatorial means to impose their viewpoint on the rest of the staffs, on the listeners, and on the communities that have long seen Pacifica as a beacon of dissent, of progressive thought, and culture in America.
I still go back to my question, and I appreciate your concerns. I appreciate the concerns of all the people. But if you were to look in Israel today and you were to speak with a concerned Israeli and a concerned Arab, you would have two points of view. To automatically assume one is right or the other is wrong, unless all of it is taken back in its historical context, would be, in effect, to take sides. Same way in Northern Ireland. Who's right in Northern Ireland, the Protestants or the Catholics? Who's right in Rwanda, the Tutsis who dominated, or the Hutu who were the majority but who were subservient for over 100 years after colonialism ended? It is very difficult to assume, based upon purely someone associating with some progressive issue. Where are all these progressives when it comes to supporting the station over the years? Where are all these people who have been part of these movements supporting the station in its financial crisis long before the current one? I've been at the station 24 years and 3 months, 5 days a week, and at the station physically for 19 years. every day and frequently spending at least 40 to 60 hours a week working on these issues. And I'm always concerned about people who in the audience will raise their voice and complain about something they don't like, but don't raise their hand to be counted upon supporting that very station that gives freedom a place to be expressed. What is wrong with people who have backgrounds that may be professional? Should we take a vote and say anyone who comes from a progressive professional background is no longer allowed to be a part of our policymaking decision? Because then what we have is anarchy or chaos, and I believe that you would agree that we've had too much of that at the station.
Oh, absolutely.
Irrespective of the national board.
Right.
I pleaded with the national board on 100 occasions to intercede at the station and to help clean it up, and no one lifted a finger,
right,
including the local board. I believe that we have to accept at some point that we may be dealing with ideological differences between localism without controls, where people don't want and actually are offended by authority and management giving them any dictate or guidance, versus those who believe that in order to have a solvent future, just to exist, you have to put systems in place that have to maintain some professional standards, or you're not going to have programs across the board that are listenable, and you're not going to have stations that are solvent, and if the stations aren't solvent, the foundation won't be solvent, because we both know the foundation and the stations for years teetered on the brink of bankruptcy.
Right.
Do we draw that line of tolerating or actually encouraging disparate points of view or different ideologies to come together?
Well, I definitely am in favor of the light and knowledge coming from the debate and conflict between ideas, and therefore I believe that the more voices and distinct voices that are heard, the better. But when you talk about this issue of, for instance, you were talking about before how can I be sure that folks are guilty, and the process issue that has been raised. What was the process that went into these many firings that have occurred, for instance, and bannings at WBAI? Was somebody given a warning? Was somebody brought to a hearing? I'll give you one example, Bernard White. Bernard White, who a veteran like you at the station for decades, I've heard you, Treece Leet, on the air many times say that there was a cause, there was a reason that soon will be known by everyone as to why Bernard was fired. But, you know, Bernard went down to unemployment, and he filed for an unemployment claim, and Pacifica did not challenge his unemployment claim. Now, when you don't challenge the unemployment claim of someone, that means that you did not fire him for cause. But so that as far as their only public statement, legally, where you can read it in public information to the state of New York unemployment insurance, they told them that Bernard White was not fired for cause. Yet we have continued to hear from you, Treece, over the air that someday, it's been now 6 months, but someday we will hear the reason why this loyal employee and for so many years was fired, or by why so many of the others were fired.
And I unfortunately, we're out of time, Juan, and those are legitimate questions, and those are questions that need to be raised and need to be answered. I will be interviewing you, Treece Leet, and I will ask her those questions. And hopefully we will get the answers that we have all been waiting for. In the interim, I appreciate everyone's efforts to try to create a healing in this, yours, your groups, and all the others.
And I welcome yours, because I think it's very important that somewhere in Pacifica there's been an airing of both sides, and that you have been able to do this, I think, is a definite step in the right direction. Unfortunately, I wish it was happening actually throughout the network, but at least you took the step, and I congratulate you for that, and I hope that it does provide the listeners with a better opportunity to understand right from wrong.
Thank you very much, Juan Gonzalez. Juan, give us your number if people would like to more information on your organization.
Yes. Well, if they want to reach the Pacifica campaign, it's 646-230-9588. It's 646-230-9588, or on the web, they can just go to www.pacificacampaign.org.